Welcome to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast with Alex Dean and Brian Cunningham. Here we have a drink, have a laugh, and you just might learn something about our favorite stories from history.
Please visit our website at hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you like the show, please rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Cheers.
Cheers, everybody. Welcome back to the Hidden History Happy Hour. Alex, today we're going to get right to a public service announcement. Now that you are a public figure, bona fide public figure, we can't have any cases of mistaken identity. So for people who are researching you, you are not this Philip Dean that we're about to talk about.
That is correct. I'm going to tell a story from the memoir of Philip Dean, No Relation, Captive in Korea, which I told in my book, Lessons from History. And the reason that I came to this Philip Dean of the Observer, no relation, as Brian stresses, is that coincidentally, when he was a captive in Korea, and he had no way of knowing this was the case at the time, he was in captivity with George Blake, one of the worst traitors of our country, who misled himself hugely about the consequences of his actions, whose remarkably appalling memoirs, but still fascinating, but appalling memoirs, are called No Other Choice. You had plenty of choices and didn't need to betray your country, my friend, with the hammer and sickle on the front. And so I read both of them.
I just wonder, Alex, if Ed Snowden's going to write volume two of that.
I'd be fascinated to read that too. There's a journalist in the UK called Simon Cooper, who's very thoughtful, and K-U-P-E-R. And I read a column of his that mentioned Philip Dean's book, Captive in Korea, which led me to George Blake's No Other Choice. You always have that chain of reading. And so that's how I came to this story in Lessons from History. As you say, Philip Dean, no relation, and the Observer's man in Korea at the outset of their civil war, 50-53. And he was taken prisoner by the North Koreans whilst reporting on the front line. He, by the way, obviously give it away because he wrote the book afterwards, he survives. He had a remarkable career after the war. It's an interesting footnote. He became a senator in Canada and he became a minister in Greece. So British paper reporter served in two other countries in their electorates. His memoirs are absolutely fascinating, and they later came to attention, as I say, because the MI6 officer, George Blake, a traitor par excellence, defected to the Russians via their Korean communist allies. And as the British did not know this for some decades to come, he, of course, went on to betray his country from within the secret intelligence service many times over. Point about Dean's story is that prisoners taken by the North Koreans, civilians included, were treated incredibly badly. He had taken several bullets to the leg in the course of his capture, and his wounds were left untreated for some time. By the way, he wasn't a combatant, he was a journalist. He still got shot several times as he was being arrested. And those wounds were left untreated for a good length of time. He was interned with other civilians, Americans, French, and others. And they were interned in an old school in a remote location, completely unsuitable for anyone living in. But then he was taken into Pyongyang, full of promises of rewards and release, in an attempt to get him to broadcast propaganda for the regime, which he did not do. But while he was in Pyongyang, his captors received representations about him from the British authorities and indeed others from members of the press in the same way that we make representations about members of the press detained wrongly today. And the North Koreans were finally convinced that he was a genuine journalist and not a spy that they suspected, or at least pretended to suspect.
Suspected.
So in order to heighten his fears and to try and get him to broadcast. So at long last, they treat his wounds and they kept him for a while he was convalescing in this big old house, which I assume had been commandeered by the regime in Pyongyang. When Pyongyang was bombed by the UN, bear in mind, some people forget this, it was a war by the United Nations against North Korea. The UN bombed Pyongyang And whenever that happened, his captors would flee to bomb shelters, leaving him in the house. They wouldn't let him come in the bomb shelter. They'd leave him in the house. There's a great detail in his memoirs that I loved. They'd walk slowly down the stairs. They'd walk slowly out the door, pretend to be calm and untroubled. And as soon as they thought themselves out of sight, they would sprint for the bomb shelter. But Philip Dean could see them from the windows of the house. Anyway. There were several broken radios around the house. They checked all the radios, made sure they didn't work so he couldn't use them. But during the bombing breaks that he had, he found that if he switched parts between the junked radios, he could get one of them to work. And in that way, he came to learn.
So does he have the run of the house then while they're in the bomb?
He's just there on his own. He's in this big old house that he's convalescing in. He's got a bound up leg. Maybe they don't think he's as mobile as he is. He's certainly not restrained in any way. He's got the run of the house. And that's how he came to learn of the birth of Princess Anne, who was the sister of our then Princess Elizabeth, our late queen. And he took this news back to the school with the other interned civilians when he was finally sent back there when he'd finished with his convalescence. As those people continued to be treated terribly, some amongst their numbers dying of starvation whilst the Koreans held them, the French diplomatic delegation, which had been imprisoned with him, somehow obtained some paper left in a corner in the school, stolen from the guards. He never knew. And using home, they were never given pen or paper, obviously. They made homemade writing tools and they inscribed a formal letter of congratulations on the birth of Princess Anne to Vivian Holt, who was the British minister from the mission in Seoul, who was also interned alongside them and comes out of Dean's memoirs very well. Anyway, this story of knowing the proper thing to do and of adhering to one's duty, even if it might seem silly and far removed from one's circumstances, you know, perhaps deriving from some sense from it that there was still some normality, a sense of normality that yet survived. Even with a knowing sense of absurdity and doing it despite the dangers that the theft involved. I mean, you get caught with writing material, you'd probably be killed. Despite all of those things, this gesture touched me and I therefore wanted to share it with my readers. And of course, I wrote it knowing that others will, of course, hold very different views on monarchy to my own. But I found it striking to think that our link to a time so greatly removed from our own, Korean War of 1950 to 53, was embodied in the lives of the royals featured in this anecdote, the same queen that served our country when my book was published and is sadly no longer with us. So that's the story of the strangest diplomatic letter written to congratulate Britons in captivity by French in captivity with stolen material from Koreans in the course of the Korean War.
Well, it's a story about the human spirit, isn't it?
And absolutely right.
You know, I suggested we do this today for a couple of reasons. One is, of course, your recent addition to your family. So that goes a little bit. But also, you know, we're living through this time where Evan Gershkovitz, the Wall Street Journal reporter, was brutally taken by the Russians and being held, probably tortured. We hope not, but certainly possible given Putin's track record. We see Hamas in Gaza saying to the world that our tunnels are only for our fighters and you have to protect the citizens, our own citizens. And so it just kind of shows you that two things have survived, probably will always survive. One, the brutality that humans are capable of. And two, right, the spirit of resistance and normalcy and tradition that we're also capable of.
That's well put, especially, I remember reading Bill Browder's book, Red Notice, and he talks about the savagery Browder was too high profile, I think, for them to actually do something to him. Although the Russians have proven their willingness to do remarkably outre and obvious things, including in my country, where they murdered someone with a refined laboratory product, an isotope polonium 210 that you
basically leave it a calling card.
Correct. I did this. I'm Vladimir Putin. So I'm probably wrong in saying Browder was too high profile. But what they did was interrogate, torture, and kill his lawyer, Magnitsky, which is why we have the Magnitsky Acts around the world as a result. And Browder in that book talks about, he's done so much, it's amazing what someone can do if they're devoted enough and have enough money and they're willing to use that money on something they really care about. He has found out so much about what the Russians did in the course of their seizure of his lawyer, completely wrongful arrest and abuse of him. And he writes in that book, you know, this can happen to you. And this can happen to, if this can happen to a lawyer in a system, it can happen to anyone. And I thought at the time, well, gosh. And then, of course, as you rightly say, Gershkovitz, seized by the Russians, yeah, you would have thought the international press might have given some kind of protection. I don't mean the press were meant to protect him. I meant his status in the press might have protected him. Absolutely not. So over time, I've just come to realize how right Browder was and how right you are now in saying that those are eternal verities, especially in Putin's Russia.
Yeah, and that's why I say I worry about how he's being treated. Gershkovitz is being treated and kept because of what happened to Magnitsky. And in fact, I at the time of that incident, you may or may not recall this, but I was actually doing some cybersecurity work, believe it or not, for some entities in Russia. This was the time when it was post-Cold War and Putin hadn't quite shown all of his stripes yet. And a big international law firm had this client and I was over there doing some work. And when that happened with Magnitsky, I fired my clients, which cost a lot of money. money. It cost the people that were working for me money, but I just wasn't willing to subject Americans to that risk of being put in that situation. If you're going to arrest and imprison and torture and kill an American lawyer or a dual lawyer, I forget which he was, then really no one's safe. And I think the same thing's true today.
Yeah. And of course, the other aspect that's different in the Philip Dean memoir is that alongside journalists, they also seized and imprisoned, brutalized, and through starvation killed diplomats. And that's one of the last things regimes tend to do, not out of any goodness, but because they don't want their own diplomats mistreated in the other countries. And that showed the depravity of the North Korean regime, the way that they were willing to let the French and American, British diplomats, you know, die off in this freezing school that they dumped them in. Not, you know, so that they could say we didn't actually, you know, stick a knife in them, but you might have as well have done. Yeah. And Dean's memoirs about the Koreans are demonstrate how brutal the North Korean regime was, which just makes it so remarkable to me that George Blake defected to them in the midst defected to the Russians via them.
Yeah.
He sought out the Koreans to make that offer. And of course, the other thing that is incredible is it goes to show what different qualities of different beliefs and ideologies can make to different lives, because the people in North Korea are brutalized, repressed, poor, and hungry. And the people of vibrant South Korea are free, liberal, democratic. You happen to be gay or of a different faith or you know, want to leave the country, no problem on any of those issues. And, you know, freedom in the end will out. I remember that remarkable image from space of the black spot on the earth of North Korea at night, the bright burning lights of freedom in South Korea, and even the brighter environment of China around North Korea.
Yeah.
But where this despotic regime reigns, there is darkness.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing, though, to end this first story on a little bit happier note is, I remember Senator John McCain telling various stories about his brutal captivity in Vietnam, which people will remember. And if not, you can look it up. But also how absolutely important it was to the morale of the men that were tortured and kept and put in captivity in Hanoi to try to keep up any semblance of a modern democratic, you know, system inside the prison. So these rituals and these, first of all, it was the right thing to do. And it, as you say in the story, it was the, dare I say, Christian thing to do. But also, I think when you're in that kind of captivity, any way you can cling to civilization as you knew it,
right,
so helps your mental state.
Yes, I think that's right. And there's an amazing array of, you know, Brian Keenan's Evil Cradling. Is the Terry Waite, who was a long-term captive, deeply Christian, with emissary of the Archbishop of Canterbury, all the way through to soldiers who had mnemonics and songs that they would sing to themselves to remind themselves of the soldiers alongside whom they were imprisoned, so that when they got home, if they got home, they could repeat the names so that people at least knew what had happened to their loved ones. People were latched onto something.
Yeah.
They had something that they that kept them going.
Yeah. And when you get counter-interrogation training by the government, if you're fortunate or unfortunate enough to get that, that is one of the things they teach you, is how you can keep in your own mind, for your own sanity, some semblances of your own civilization and how you can keep your mind active. And one of the ways is just what you said, is memorizing every single thing you possibly can about your captors, your location, your treatment. Is there, you know, is there a sound of a train station outside? Do you hear airplanes flying overhead? And also the people you're captive with, so that if you're fortunate enough to get out, you can take advantage of that information. But it also helps keep you sane while you're inside.
Right.
So we're going to switch to a story that involves your favorite country, Alex, of France. And I selected a little Napa Valley white wine today because didn't have any French white here. But this is very similar to white Bordeaux that you might run across in France.
Well, a house without white French wines is very sad. So I will I'll have to try and fix that for you, my friend. I, for my part, Henry, my son's got his first cold, and I am, I'm afraid you're drinking for two. And I know it's crazy early where you are and it's nighttime where I am, but I'm drinking alcohol-free beer just because it's alcohol on top of baby cold. Not a good idea. Anyway.
Never let me say I did not do the least I could do.
It's much appreciated. Cheers. Mm. This story is called Someone Had To. Mary Lindell. She may have pronounced it Lindell, Comtesse de Millville. She was British. She married into French aristocracy, and she won the Croix de Guerre in both World Wars. This is very interesting. Both World Wars won the Croix de Guerre, despite her disdain for the French, open and of its time, which led her to stay during occupation by the Germans rather than flee to safety, as someone had to stand up to the Jerrys. So she was a nurse with the Red Cross serving on the Western Front during the First World War. And her heroism during her later years in the Second World War was no less significant, but I think rather more colourful. So I'm going to tell that story. The Comtesse ran an underground network that secured the safe transportation of Allied airmen who had been shot down over France back to Britain and the ability to return to the fight. It is a feature of a... relatively long-running and much-loved sitcom in my country called Allo, Allo! In occupied France. It has these two British airmen who pop out of barrels and so forth, and people got
hidden under the floorboards. Do you happen to know, Alex, what we call that in the United States of America?
Allo, Allo! I don't.
Hogan's Heroes.
Okay, but that's a different show.
Yeah, but it was produced, it started in 1964. Imagine writing a situation comedy about a German POW camp in 1964, 19 years after the conflict.
Same plot. I remember Herman's Hogan's Heroes. It's got this slightly larger German guy. I'm not nothing. And so, I remember that. But this is Allo, Allo! Is much more slapstick, and so you certainly couldn't make it now. It's got lots of, you know, a good British joke is a repeat running joke about painting with large breasts.
Right.
That sort of thing. But anyway, so captive Allied airmen has always been a feature of British remembrances about the war, but it's real. And it was calculated after the war that she, the Comtesse, had helped 100 airmen to escape from France. One of the hardest things we had to do was train pilots to fly well enough to not get shot down and or die and lose their precious aircraft in the course of it. So 100 airmen helped by one woman on their way is a great achievement. And one route was known as the Marie Claire line because it was named after her code name that we, the Allies, had given her as an operative. And she would get the aviators to a farm straddling the border between occupied and Vichy France at the time when those regimes were different, from whence they would be helped by agents to get to Britain. And the Germans knew that she was up to something. And she was often, not once, she was often arrested, imprisoned, interrogated. And indeed, in 1941, when she was swooped up, she served a year's imprisonment, after which she escaped to Britain herself, received training from MI9, which was the group that helped people to train people to escape. And remarkably, she then returned to France to carry on helping airmen to escape. She was not alone in her work. Her sons both assisted her, and her sons were therefore tortured as a result by the Nazis. Her eldest son, Morris, was freed by the SS and returned to his mother, having been beaten so badly that, in her memorable phrase, he looked like strawberry jam. And his freedom was obtained from the Germans after a process that was only admitted to in the 1980s, only came out many years after the war. The senior Nazi concerned had faced trial for his misdoings in the course of the Second World War, and in the course of evidence, it emerged that the Countess had bribed him to release Maurice, and she gave him a pile of franc notes cut in half, the other half to be given to him on her son's safe return and release. And who can possibly blame a mother for this bribery, especially given what happened, I'm afraid, to her younger son, Octavius? The family were unable to obtain this brave young man's release, captured again because they were helping the Allies. And after the cruelest privations, he died in a concentration camp. And finally, luck ran out for the Countess Lindel herself. Fleeing from capture, she was again, right? She was fleeing from capture and she was shot in the head and survived to be thrown into the infamous Ravensbrück concentration camp, where, in her rather understated words, conditions were pretty dim for the general public. A wonderfully low-key turn of phrase. Conditions were pretty dim for the general public in this notorious concentration camp. Special Operations Executive Agents, SOE, who were imprisoned alongside Lindel, credited her fortitude, her example, and her practical help with saving their lives during their captivity. And as much of a pain to the Reich in imprisonment as she was at large, she was hated by her captors. And as the war drew close, they were gradually releasing people as they, and of course, got less organized, as we reflected in a recent story, as order broke down in the Reich. But as the war drew close, she was held back until the very last bus of prisoners was released from the camp. She lived in Paris, this woman who had this disdain for the French that she never concealed. She lived in Paris to the end of her days, and she proved somewhat challenging for biographers and chroniclers who would approach her and ask for inside scoop and so forth. I think she would tell them precisely where they could go. And her brother said that she was so difficult for the Gestapo to deal with because she was difficult with everyone. And, you know, so what? With a record of heroism like this, the lesson, I think, is obvious. History is made by bloody difficult women.
Well, salute to her. And RIP to her loved ones.
Amen.
Mentioning, as you did, how difficult she was to would-be biographers,
right.
I'm interested at the end of the last story that you mentioned the chain of reading that led you to that story. So what got you to this story? How'd you find it?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think it was a reader submission. I think someone who'd read Volume One got in touch and said, have you read this story about this remarkable woman? And gosh, I'm so glad they did, because you will appreciate, you know, the stories in the books are, you know, 2-3 pages long, but in order to get there, I often have to read lots of stuff. And she was a pleasure to read about, and I loved, as I was reading it, I'm a child of, you know, a certain age, as we all are, and I had all those heroic images of France under captivity, and back from the most serious to the low end of the spectrum. And that was, people of my age grew up with veterans of the Second World War all around us, and that's not true now.
Yeah,
young people now don't have that same experience. But so to read more real aspects of this from a British woman who had chosen to go to France, not once, but multiple times in the course of that, and to stay there in the occupation and so forth. It was great fun. But in answer to your question, it was a reader submission.
Yeah, crowdsourcing.
The books have been crowdsourced, and if I ever get around to Volume 3 will be as well. I've got about enough material at the moment for half of Volume 3, being a political candidate has rather slowed things down somewhat, but it's still going.
Well, I encourage people to continue to submit those stories. I actually have even submitted a couple of my own successfully.
You have indeed. You feature prominently in the acknowledgements, and what I might make not make up for in huge sales, or the books have sold pretty well. I certainly make up for with fulsome acknowledgements.
The one silver lining for me personally in however long it takes for volume 3 to get out is our viewers and listeners will remember I made a promise that season 2 of the Hidden History Happy Hour will not end until every story from these two volumes is told.
It's going to be a long season. But if we keep up this clip and we do two stories an episode, it won't take us that long.
So tell us tales from the campaign trail real quick before we let people.
So today it's a local election week. And so my campaign takes a back seat. It feels a bit strange if you go and say, hello, I'm campaigning for the election after next. So, you know, you campaign for the next election that's in front of you and you help out your colleagues who are in campaigning in the locals. And then you hope that they come return the favor and come and help you in the general election. But despite the fact that's this week and Thursday, which would normally be very much the focus, the First Minister of Scotland, Hamza Youssef, has just quite spectacularly resigned. And you're a man who likes a political anecdote, so I will share this with you. Hamza Youssef, extraordinary, went into coalition with the Green Party in Scotland. He's the leader of the Scottish National Party, the SNP. Goes into coalition with the Greens, maintains the coalition with the Greens that he inherited. He wasn't elected by the people as leader. His predecessor was in scandal and so forth, and he came through the middle to become leader. He said that coalition was worth its weight in gold, which I always think it's quite telling when someone mixes his metaphors like that, because coalition is a concept that has no weight, which might actually be telling. Anyway, he then refuses to honour their commitments in government. And then as they become increasingly agitated with him, he dismisses them from government. He reminds me of the man who's sitting on the branch of a tree who saws the branch off and is then surprised when he falls, because he boots out the people who, together with his party, constitute a majority in the parliament. And they say, I can't believe it. I haven't got a majority. This is outrageous. And he tries to struggle on as if somebody somehow owes him the living, owes him votes without being in government with him. And the people who had been, who had defected from his party elsewhere, who took great glee in saying no, they wouldn't prop him up. And he'd taken great glee in them leaving and said he didn't care about it. I mean, the hubris on show is wonderful. But on the other hand, I will tell you this. He's the third SNP First Minister. The first, Alex Salmond, First Minister of Scotland, was arrested by the police Scotland. The second, Nicola Sturgeon, second SNP First Minister of Scotland, was arrested by Police Scotland. Hamza Youssef, the third SNP First Minister of Scotland, was not arrested by Police Scotland. And this is a significant achievement, therefore. He is the first SNP First Minister not to have been arrested by, first and only, so far, not to have been arrested by the Police Scotland. So, you know, that it can only be English nationalism that means that has not prevailed as the headline in his time in office. Albeit, I will point out to you, he must be, because he introduced new hate crime legislation, which basically meant you could complain about anything. And the police in the week after it was introduced received more complaints than they'd received in the year prior. I'm pretty sure more than half of them were about him. So he's almost certainly the person most reported to the police. Which, of course, doesn't mean you've done anything wrong. But that's nevertheless a signal achievement.
Well, it sounds like math is not really his strong suit. And I do have some sympathy for that because it's the same with me. But Alex, I can't help but ask, are you saying that Scottish politics is off kilter?
Hey, very good. Very, very good. Yes. His term in office was, I think, just very slightly over a year. But, you know, people tend to serve long terms in Scottish politics. And so the headline of today's Spectator was Briefheart, which I thought was pretty good.
So you may recall this, Alex. There was a time in the United States, I believe it was around 2010, when a governor of the state of Illinois was convicted and sent to prison for attempting to sell the recently vacated Senate seat of Barack Obama after he was elected president.
I do recall that.
At the time, four of the last five governors of Illinois had been sent to prison for some sort of corruption.
That's remarkable.
So now, what are we, 14 years later? It's probably only like 5 out of 8 or something, 5 out of 7.
Right, but you must get out of that office and think, whoo, dodge that one. There's a serious point here that, of course, venality and corruption in politics, on the one hand, is always overstated. On the other hand, it's always there. And you know, since time immemorial, you know, the Senate's great site of great speeches in Rome was also had its fair share of corruption. I'm sure Athenian democracy, for all its bright and shining virtues, had much the same set of issues. Albeit, of course, it was far more convenient when you didn't actually let most people vote. You called it democracy, but you look at how many people actually had a vote. It wasn't that many. But anyway. On the other hand, whilst I say this is there, it's never as bad as people in the media today say it is, but it's always been there. The extent to which we now take our political fights and take it into lawfare, and you know, a way to stop someone getting into office is to bring enough lawsuits against them or to snow them with enough legal issues. I think this may be pretty bad for democracy, and the trouble is, it's an arms race, right? Once one side starts doing it, the other side thinks, well, we're going to deny ourselves a vital tool unless we do it too.
Yeah, so there's a flip side to that. I don't disagree with you, but there's a flip side to that story. And as we record this in late April 2024, it's very fresh in my mind because I observed this last Thursday. I did a large Twitter space, X space on it. And that is the hearing in our Supreme Court, in the U.S. Supreme Court, over the claim by former President Trump that he and all future presidents are entitled under our Constitution to absolute immunity from any criminal prosecution anytime in the future, no matter what they do.
Yeah, look, I know that in our world, in our professional world, I'm probably an outlier and not sort of despising President
Trump. It's not going to be political, but go ahead.
I see no justification for that. The idea you should have absolute, unqualified immunity for everything, that's completely unjustifiable. And it's an incentive for the worst types of people to pursue public life. I do see a case for qualified immunity for decisions taken in office about office, not about what you did with your real estate or whatever while you were in office, but for, you know, for legitimate decisions. Yeah. We had an MP in the UK hounded out because he supposedly bullied civil servants. And one of the things he was supposedly bullying of him was criticizing the negotiating position being taken by our ambassador in Spain over what the future of Gibraltar was going to be. I mean, that was his job.
That's the core of his job.
That was his job.
Yeah.
Right, and we run the risk of forcing people out of public office, which in the bad way.
Absolutely. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, because by the time this airs, there may or may not be a Supreme Court decision. Probably not, but there will be one soon. I will predict, as I did before the hearing and during the hearing, that there will either be 9-0 vote, that there's no absolute immunity, despite the fact that the Trump-appointed justices control the court, or possibly 8-1, that there's no absolute immunity. But Alex, to your point, I believe they're also going to find that which I agree with, and I used to litigate this stuff for the government, if a president is acting in his or her official capacity, doing an act that is core to the function of the presidency, right, and they're doing it, even if they're wrong, even if you don't like their politics, even if you don't like their decision-making, even if it was a disaster, they do have immunity for that. And that's where it should come out.
So the court is not controlled by Trump-appointed judges. It's controlled by Republican president-appointed judges. But more broadly, I accept your point.
Well, okay, let me rephrase. The control of the Supreme Court by conservative justices was achieved during the Trump administration.
Correct. I completely agree. And that it's controlled by conservative justices broadly, although Roberts is no longer a reliable vote. But I agree with that. But of course, these things are always a ramp up over several terms. And a number of them were appointed under President Bush and so forth.
And let me say something else, which may surprise people who think they know my politics. Amy Coney Barrett, who was infamously chastised by the left in our country for being a Trump puppet. And she just owed everything to Trump. But she was
nonsense.
First of all, she voted with the 9-0 court on three cases overturning his claims about the 2020 election.
Yeah.
And she absolutely, I don't know, I know you're a famous debater, Alex. If you go watch this, listen to this hearing, she absolutely took the male lawyers apart. And what she specifically did with the Trump lawyer, which I think is going to be historic, is she went through count by count by count by count, five different counts of the January 6th indictment against former President Trump, and said, I'm going to read this to you, Mr. Trump lawyer. Is this personal conduct or is this official conduct? And got him to concede on all four or five that it was personal conduct with no legitimate connection to his office. So one, I promise you that is going to be part of the test.
Yeah, it's good.
And two, that means no matter what the court finds and no matter what the lower court does, those counts of the indictment will stand. Now, it's still, I believe, a political tactical victory for former President Trump, because what it also means is by the time it goes back to the lower courts, there's no chance it gets tried before the 2024 election. But constitutionally, and for the future of our little republic against tyranny, I think they're going to do the right thing.
Well, Hidden History Happy Hour listeners, you didn't know you're going to get some Supreme Court chat alongside the most unusual diplomatic letter, which I enjoyed telling you. And somebody had to. A story of daring do and bravery from a contest in the Second World War. There you have it. I thought that was great.
Thanks, we have Brian. Multi eras of history, and we have instant history on this program.
Instant history.
Cheers, my friend.
Cheers, buddy.
See you next time, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for topics, you can find us on Twitter or on our website, hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com. We look forward to joining you next time.
Much gratitude to our multi-talented production team of Jeremy Corr, Kate Cruz, and Grace Keller, and to our visionary executive producer, Ivan Williams. And thanks also to our art designer, David Wardle.
Without whom this podcast would be, well, history.
Cheers.